sake of the call.
It's a group called Lord's Song, and that's a song called The Call from, well, more than just a few years ago. It's 11 minutes after the hour on a terrific Tuesday morning here. And on the line with us now, Dr. Don Clark. He is a member of the board at Creation Moments and a biochemist and a vintner. And he lives in Garden Valley, Texas. And Don, happy Tuesday. Good to have you along.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, it is a bright, sunny Tuesday morning and quite still here, but it's probably going to get up to mid-70s, if not 80 today down here.
Envy.
Yeah, no,
just stop it. Just stop it. Just quit.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're I wouldn't say tropical, but we're bordering on it.
And is there green stuff around yet? Is it like grass and leaves on the trees?
We've had to cut our grass already.
What?
Wow.
Oh.
Really?
I can almost smell that.
Oh, yeah.
That cut grass. Well,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
I could cut mine, but I think the lawnmower would freeze up. That'd be a problem, you know.
Have to use your snowmower.
I got vine shoots now. They're about 6 inches long.
Mm-hmm. Wow, wow. You think is there any way to know if it's, you know, at this point, if it's going to be a good year or not a good year? There's really no way to tell.
Yeah, we're talking the grapes on his grape ranch here. So
You can get a little bit of a hint as to what's happening in the vineyard by some of the shoots are already starting to show the grape buds clusters. Mm. And so if everything works well, those grape bud clusters will turn into clusters of grapes.
You know, I understand that over in the far north of Norway, in what they call Lapland, that Laplanders who herd reindeer for a living can go outside and sniff the air and predict a snowstorm 3 days in advance. I mean, they're that sensitive to the environment and their vocation, which is raising and taking care of reindeer. I'm wondering if you're on a grape ranch in Texas, can you go outside and sniff the air and read the weather 3 days in advance now? I mean, you've been doing this for, what, a year, 2 years now? Are you adapted?
Oh, we've been. Mm-hmm. No, actually, we've been doing it. This is the sixth growing season.
Oh, 6 years. Okay.
Mm. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, then you should be able to go outside, sniff the air, and determine the weather for a fair growing season. Can you do that, or do you check your cell phone?
We kind of do both. check your cell phone. Check your climate gauge that we have in the house here. So all of those things, we figure out, well, is this a good day to spray, or is it, what's going to happen? We're going to have rain anytime soon, because you don't want to spray and then it rains, or at least spray with the wrong stuff and then it rains, because it just washes it off.
Dr. Don is a man close to the earth now, after 6 years on the grape ranch. And that comes in handy when you look at an article like this from the Smithsonian. They're digging through rocks here and finding what they claim to be early life on Earth in the form of bacteria. They look like just tubes to me. I'm looking at a picture of them here. There's a link to the article that we're talking about in the chat window on RokenRoadRadio.com right now if you'd like to go through the article with us. Don, what are they talking about here? They're talking about life that's a half billion years older than what scientists used to think, huh?
Well, that's what the article is claiming, and that's what the authors are claiming about this. And what they found is like crystalline material that had that have these grow tubes in them, and I'm not talking about the fluorescent light. It's the tubes that certain bacteria make, causes kind of mineral deposits in the shape of a tube. So they actually didn't find the bacteria, but they found these tubes and says, aha.
Well, they're fossils technically, aren't they?
The tube is the remnant of the bacteria's existence.
Okay.
In the environment that this this particular rock was in the environment of these bacteria, it's heat-loving bacteria that you know might have metabolized, for example, hydrogen sulfide instead of you know oxygen for their oxidative you know system, and so. You know, this rock was obviously at one point or another under the ocean, and it was in a volcanic, a very large volcanic area.
So these critters would be similar to what we see today down in deep sea vents, where there's hot water and strange gases and chemicals coming out of the earth. And that's what they're talking about.
Right. It would well, except the tubes there. Actually, some of those are made by worms. Or heat loving and hydrogen sulfide loving. So it's very, very similar to that. Matter of fact, at one point in the article, they say, hey, you know, these are so remarkable. They look like something that we find in modern day.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the questions that you should ask is, hey, if it's modern day and they look very, very similar to that, how can they be 4.3 billion years old?
It's a good question.
I mean, you know, that would be my first question. So why are you dating these rocks, you know, so old to begin with?
Well, now the bacteria and whatever they left in the form of a tube, the article says, that were converted to stone by iron in their environment, iron in the water, I suppose. So what they're looking at is a mineral. How do you date minerals?
It's a mineral.
How do you date minerals? I mean, is it radiocarbon dating, or is that just you know, this is not, I don't think you can call this organic material. It's a mineral.
It's a mineral. There are minerals, and you can, there's various ways of dating rocks, but my guess is that they didn't date these at all.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is that they're using the date of the deposit that they were found in Canada. So this was a band of they call it greenstone belt in Quebec, Canada, which is not necessarily on the coast of, you know, in Canada, but it's it looks like it's fairly you know, a little bit inland, but it's this belt, this band. They don't give the size or anything, but that had a lot of volcanic activity. And volcanic activity then followed by a lot of sedimentary deposits over it, which to me, you know, kind of screams the flood.
Yeah.
As we, you know, have talked about many times in the past, that there was a lot of volcanic activity at the time of the flood. And why was that? Well, because that was the time when the continents were drifting apart. And so you had, you know, the Earth's crust was opening up and splitting, and you had a lot of volcanic activity. You had a lot of course, a lot of water movement at the time. Not only was there water coming from, you know, the sky, but there was a great deal of water coming from the deep as well.
Which makes sense to me now, because we've talked about that in the past, how scientists have recently discovered huge amounts of water locked up in the minerals in the earth, more water in fact than are currently in the oceans on the surface of the earth.
That's right. I mean, mm-hmm. two-thirds, I mean, it's like twice as much water.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you read scripture and says that God's spirits hovered over the face of the waters, anyway, I don't want to get into a long explanation of this, but the evidence you know, masses of amount of water, not only on our planet, but it has been found at least in other planets as well, accounting for, among other things, electromagnetic belt that we have around our Earth. And you know, there's still a big controversy as to what's formed that. But that being another topic, maybe for another time. Mm-hmm. But we are, with these deposits, then there it's screaming a flood evidence, which the creation model, for example, of how the Earth's geology got completely redone at the time of the flood, and where you started, with this one big landmass, which we've called Pangaea, broke up into several pieces, which are now our major continents, and then the continents drift apart, not slowly, but very, very quickly, because of all of the volcanic activity that was going on, and all of the lava and everything that was oozing
out. It's hard for us to imagine a truly global event, because we just haven't seen it again,
lifetime. I mean, things have settled down, quite a bit. We still have some evidence of it, though, happening rather slowly. The continents seem to have reached an equilibrium, although they're still moving apart a little bit. And so, the traditional way would say, okay, if the continents are moving, we measure how quickly or how slowly they're moving apart. We extrapolate back linearly, and that's how long this event, took in the past. Well, you can't just take a couple of points and assume that actually happened in the past. But that is the traditional way of the evolutionist and of, natural geologists, deep age geologists. That's their typical way of analyzing these types of things.
So assuming, for example, that the continents have always been drifting at the same rate as they are today, it would take a long time for them to have gained the separation they have. Although scientists tend to agree that there was this Pangaea, one landmass on the Earth that is secular and non-secular. I don't know what non-secular means, but people who believe in biblical creation would agree that there was one solid continent, one mass, and it broke apart. So what dawns on me again is how two groups of scientists, one who is grounded in the Bible and in Scripture, and the other that is grounded in empirical evidence, can look at the same set of data and reach entirely different conclusions.
Well, yes, because I mean they're assuming, for example, I mean 4.3 billion years old, according to the evolution, cosmic evolution, it's estimated that our planet, our Earth, is 4.5 billion years old. Mm-hmm. So these bacteria, for some reason, just happened to show up as early as 0.2 billion years from, in quote, the start of the planet, which at that time, if you take the evolutionary model, would have been extremely hot and quite volatile, no atmosphere to speak of, except for a very reducing atmosphere, and we live in a very oxidizing atmosphere. Now, I'm just giving you the mm-hmm. model. I'm not saying this is how the conditions were, because we know how the conditions were, and it wasn't that. Mm-hmm. And so all of that, all of those suppositions are written quite nicely in this in this article. And it's clear that they are using those assumptions to try to date these bacterial tubes, if you will, that found in this rock. You can see how your beginning assumptions make you come up with conclusions that are, from my point of view, completely, completely bogus in saying that these deposits are that old, in saying that, this was the first life on Earth. Well, what was the first life on Earth? That's a question that, the creationists can ponder as well. And we go back, unlike, these folks, I mean, we go back to the history book. And, well, what is one of the oldest history books that we have? It happens to be the Bible. And so if you look at Genesis as a historical record, I mean, Genesis meaning genealogy, if we look at that and say, hey, maybe God didn't leave us in the dark. Maybe he actually told us how things were created. So we look at Genesis. We look at the first chapter in Genesis. We get a very broad summary of what events took place. So the first living things that God created were plants. And you can argue, well, is a bacteria a plant or not? You know, it's kind of in its own separate group. We got plants and animals, and you got microorganisms, and those the microorganisms, of course, are in a different group than plants as we now classify them. But God said, "Let the dry land bring forth life in the form of plants." So we know that plants were created first. And here we have microorganisms being created first. Well, I don't think microorganisms were there, at the very beginning, but plants certainly were. And then after plants, we know that, on the fifth day, for example, God created the sea creatures and the air creatures, or the birds and the flying things. So the things that flew, and then the sea creatures were created next, and then finally the land animals, in topping that off with the creation of man. So that's the historical written record that we have. So even these folks saying that, these special type of bacteria that can withstand, that lived in the water, withstand this special metabolism properties, of which we have evidence for today, were the first living organisms, we assume. Even in the article, though, there is quite a lot of not all scientists even agree with this particular conclusion.
Well, this proves error in the earlier, or at least it indicates an error in the earlier assumptions. That this is saying that life occurred on Earth, in their view, 500 million years before they thought it did, which should cause some scientists to take pause and say, how could we have been so wrong in a number that we have been so sure of for so long? And this continually happens on that side of the aisle, so to speak.
Well, I mean, it does, and you can find new evidence and then try to reinterpret the evidence, which, this will happen continuously with this type of model, because you're throwing out written documentation and not even considering it at all. But even if you're at 3.7 billion years instead of 4.3 billion years, or even that assumption is wrong, mm-hmm. because of the model that you're using and the assumptions that you have on Earth. Look, we know that Earth was formed in a very short period of time. And after man was made, the Earth, and the universe for that matter, was formed perfectly. It was formed perfectly to sustain life. And so there was not this period of time where you had a hot, molten ball coming from somewhere, because the original thoughts were, well, it spun off from the sun. The sun didn't have the elements that the Earth has, so we know that certainly didn't happen. And so, you kind of get this picture that we're kind of making things up as we go. And then we find out that there's all this water under the crust of the Earth, and where did that come from? That doesn't make any sense. it makes perfect sense if you just read the history book.
Well, if the phrase "the fountains of the deep" never made sense to us until recently, that is to a secular scientist, and now they look at the ground and they say, "Oh, there is an incredible amount of water down there," whereas 50 years ago they did not know that and they doubted the phrase "fountains of the deep." That's got to be poetic. That's got to be somebody's imagination. And now they've got to say it could have been.
Well, and not only could have been, but we have evidence of dry caves, for example, relatively dry mm-hmm. caves, all over the earth, and you can visit some of them, there were rivers, lakes, rivers of water under the earth's surface, and some of it wasn't so deep. Something happened to cause that water to be exposed. And of course, if you go back to the history book, you know exactly what happened. And now, not that Genesis gives us all the details. God gave us brains. He made us in his image to be creative and to, be able to understand our environment with a little help. And so we get the little help, and then we were supposed to look at the environment, do our investigative studies, and come up with a reasonable explanation as to how the things that we see around us today, and the geology that we see in particular around us today, how that came about. And so when we eliminate the author's book, for example, and assume that we can't look at that, because if we do, then we already are assuming that there was a God, and we don't want to assume that there was a God, because that's not scientific. Mm-hmm. We archaeology, we look for pottery and we look for things that of written, whether they be of pictures or whether they be actually, some type of new, well, not new, very, very old script. We look for that to give us clues as to the culture of this material that we're finding, that man-made, in quote, material. So why in the earth sciences, in the natural sciences, we ignore the written material that has been left behind for us and preserved, and not put that as part of our investigation in order to try to understand the bigger picture and answer the bigger question as to how did we get here and why are we here? So when you eliminate that, your conclusions about why we are here are way off the scale, and you wind up with an answer that says there's no reason for man to be here. I mean, we're just animals like any other animals, and we're no different than the apes, and we're supposed to hug trees, and we're supposed to not treat anybody any better than we treat animals, or we're supposed to treat our animals better than us. And we get way off base in all of these fundamental questions and problems because we have ignored the very essence of a great book.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is like so many different fields of endeavor in humanity. We have a preconceived notion of the end or the place where we're going, and we will selectively look at evidence that supports that conclusion and ignore evidence that doesn't support that conclusion. Same thing happens in congressional investigations. It's error. And it's I'd love to define the problem we have here. And there's probably a word for it, and the Bible teaches us about it. I suppose sin could be, if we knowingly pervert the truth or ignore the truth, what's the crime? How would we be judged on that? What would we be charged with? Ignorance? No, it's intentional. It's intentional. It's not ignorance.
Right, exactly. It's you have bought you've bought the lie of the enemy. First of all, the first lie that you bought is that hey, there is no enemy. Mm-hmm. It's just you know, we are just here all by ourselves, and there's no spiritual component to us. So even in the latter part of Genesis, when in Genesis chapter 1, for example, where it tells us how we were created. And that it took the whole Godhead to create us, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. They were involved, and we are mentioned as being created in the image of God. Now, that doesn't mean that we are gods or we're little gods, but it just means that we have some of the same characteristics of God. And one of the biggest characteristics is that he is the God of creation. So that means that we have creative abilities. And he's given us, you know, a brain to be able to figure things out and all of these other stuff.
Well, let's keep it really simple. Let's just talk about that for just a second here then. We know, let's pretend this is an assumption, because we're going about this scientifically now, empirically. We know there is a creation. It's apparent that it didn't happen by accident, and that's an assumption. But the Bible tells us that we have inherited certain characteristics from the Creator, that one of the primary ones being creativity. Another one I would say would be the ability to love, but creativity, that's a very logical, empirically verifiable statement that we are creative. I mean, look at all the stuff we built and devised and systems and things we've invented and discovered and put together, all of it inferior to the original creation. But it proves that claim that there was a creator and that we inherited that talent from them. Isn't that enough proof? I mean, what else do you need?
Yes, one would think that even the ability to even look deep inside ourselves, I mean, physically, not spiritually, because that is outside the realm of natural science, if you will. But even the ability, for example, to investigate and find out that, hey, every cell in our body has this material that's called DNA. And, that's the encyclopedia of our cells. And every protein and every substance made within the cell is being controlled by this DNA material. Even that ability to understand that, and the ability to make instruments and machines to be able to see that and measure that is so far above any animal on earth that you cannot say with a straight face that, gee, we just jumped from, the ape to man, and he had all of these abilities, but the ape doesn't. And that was just a leap in evolution. We don't know why there was a leap in evolution, but there was this leap in evolution, and here we are today. We know that that happened because here we are today. I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. We must have done something right.
Yeah, we somewhere along the way. But of course, the pictures that you see in the Natural History Museum of this, this monkey kind of hunched over, and he gets a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger, and then finally he's standing straight up, and then you see this hairy man at the other end, kind of emerging, gives us the clue that hey, we were pretty dumb when we started off, and it was just through evolution that we became smarter and smarter. You know where I'm going with this. Mm-hmm. This is not what we find in the history book. We find in the history book that Adam, the first man, and Eve, I'm sure, was extremely, extremely bright, and brighter than more intelligent than what we are, today. And we see glimpses of this ingenuity and brightness from selected individuals in certain areas, in that, they're just brilliant at playing the piano or playing a musical instrument, and it was kind of like an innate, you know, ability that they had, or they're brilliant in figuring out things and in understanding math or these other
child
areas.
Child prodigies, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're artists of exquisite, you know, talent. You know, where did that all that come from? Now, if you take everything that we know in these brilliant people and you compress them into one individual, you would look at that individual and say, wow, they're kind of superhuman.
He's a superior being, yeah.
And that's where we started, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know. That's where we started.
Kind of makes me want to go eat worms, you know.
Yeah, to go back eat worms. It's tasty.
I just during the conversation in the last couple of minutes, I've been flashing back on all those Thanksgiving dinners and all those Christmas dinners, and you're sitting around talking about the, you know, the various and sundry things of life with the mom and the dad, and you know, mom looks over and says, "Well, so how's school, Dave?" And you know, and in my best honest portrayal, I'd look back and I'd say, "Well, you know, I think I'm getting dumber. I don't know as much as I did last year. You know, I'm not sure if I'm able to be able to start the car on my own. And I lost the apartment the other day." And that's the kind of thing we have to, as we finish our PhDs and we go out and we study things, that's what we have to say to ourselves, is that my forebears were much brighter than I am.
Mm-hmm.
and the hope that we have is that we just got lucky they showed up before we did, because if it would have been reversed, I don't think we would have made it.
Well, and Don, there's scientific research that indicates that's exactly true. That generation after generation, the subsequent generations have mutations in their DNA that were not in the precursor, and it was kind of a long downhill slide. Interesting tendencies here that all tend to confirm the history that we read in the Bible. And I'm not suggesting that Genesis was written to convince us scientifically. And Don, I don't think you would either. I think what Genesis was written to explain to us how God acted then, and how He gave us our start. So it's history; it's not science. And maybe
but we can draw conclusions from, you know, it's like a very very coarse outline.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. This happened, then this happened. And then you got to read in between the lines and figure out, okay, what was the mechanism for that and all this other stuff. Plenty of room for us to play in, you know, mm-hmm. and to use our creativity to fill in the blanks. But it's at least a starting point. And that's, I guess, my point of the conversation today.
Well, and the thing you've taught us over time, and now we've been doing this with you for 5 years and then some, is that we don't disagree with secular science as to the evidence, that is the observed empirical data that's been compiled. It's just that when you toss it into the matrix of the Bible, it tends to take shape that we recognize and can say, aha, it fits. It's like the pieces of a puzzle. Whereas outside of the Bible, you try to piece these together, there's always something missing. And so you continue to search, and you're bound to determine to fit whatever you find into your preconceived notions of how things have, I want to say, evolved. And that's the preconceived notion right there.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. David, did I cut you off there? Did you have a thought? I think you're
I had a thought,
frontal,
you know,
lobe
about,
is swelling
about
there,
30 like minutes ago. And you know, I keep, you know, jogging my memory so I don't forget to ask this question. And I may have asked this question before, but I want to talk about the Pangaea and the continental drift. Are the continents drifting at the same rate over time, or is there? I mean, we've been following this drift thing now for what, about 100 years? Is it a constant, or does it speed up now and then, or does it slow down, or somewhere in between?
Well, I mean, right now, within the the more recent history, it is it's about, you know, it's a very, very slow, very, very slow rate.
Like centimeters a year, I think, is what it is.
So is slower than it has been?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the point. That's the point of the creation argument, is that while it was happening, while the continents were actually breaking apart, that the amount of volcanic activity, you know, in the cracks, if you will, that was causing this this the movement, acted as a lubricant to speed the process, if you will. And it gets into a spiritual question and issue as well. But that's probably for another time. Otherwise, we'll be here for another couple of hours.
Mm-hmm. I'm willing, but you know, we got places to go and people to see.
Yeah, I've got time. Yeah, we can stick around. No, I just, and that was one of the things I was curious. I mean, that would suggest certain things too. If it's slowing down, now if it's speeding up, that would bring on some other ideas.
Well, this is one of the basic arguments we have against evolution, is that it assumes a context that's been a steady state, where things as we see it now are like they always have been.
Right, exactly.
And it denies a global event, for example. So, interesting. Dr. Don Clark, member of the Board of Creation Moments, I want to suggest to people that you visit the Creation Moments website. It's creationmoments.com. You can link to it from Broken Road Radio if you're listening there today. Otherwise, creationmoments.com. There's a new website being prepared. It'll be out here in just a few weeks. But regardless of the new site, you'll still find it a great resource for information that supports biblical creation, the creation story. And we urge you to take a look. Don, thank you. We'll see you next week, okay?
Okay, very good. You folks, stay warm up there. Stay warm.
We'll do our best. We'll bundle up here. Bye-bye.
Hey, it was 51 yesterday.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Thanks.